You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Brookings. My name is John MacArthur. I'm a senior fellow here in the Global Economy and Development Program and acting director of the Africa Growth Initiative. And we have a terrific discussion today and terrific event that we're co-hosting with the IMF and delighted to be doing so. We're here to talk about low-income developing countries and their macroeconomic development prospects. This is a report that the fund recently launched, the third in a series, and we're delighted to have, at a time when the world is very much focused on what's happening in the high-income countries and a lot of regional cooperation issues, for example, in Europe and North America in particular, it's an important moment to remember we can't take our eye off the ball as an international community from the low-income countries that are, of course, facing their own ongoing challenges as well. And, of course, many, many successes, too. So we couldn't have a better group to discuss it today, but we'll start with Dr. Tao Zhang, who's the Deputy Managing Director of the IMF. Dr. Zhang was he joined the IMF only about 8 months ago in his current role, but he was previously a Deputy Governor of the People's Bank of China. He was also, prior to that, the IMF Executive Director from China for several years, and prior to that had a distinguished career in the People's Bank of China and also working in the Asian Development Bank and the World Bank and so forth. So really a distinguished career, a tremendous perspective to bring to the multilateral system and to thinking about these issues around the world. This is co-hosted with the Africa Growth Initiative here, which is, of course, reflected in many of the low-income developing countries, but this is a truly global issue. So we'll love to kick it off with Dr. Zhang. Please, welcome to the stage.
Thank you, John, and good afternoon, everybody. First of all, I would like to thank Brookings to invite me to this event and to share with you what are the main findings of our most recent issues of the report on the low-income developing countries. As you know, the IMF paying considerable attentions, I should say persistent attentions, to its low-income members. And by what I said, the low-income countries, so-called LIDCs, I mean the, or we mean that the those who have per capita income below a certain threshold. And particularly those are eligible for our concessional financing windows from either the World Bank and the IMF. So, and we have a lot of the accurate names. I don't want to get you into it, but the, that's pretty much in sense. And clearly these LDIC or LIDC, the are a diverse group. And of course, facing different development challenges and different external shocks, and of course, require some differentiations in their analysis and responses. But adding them together, they are accounted, even though they are only accounted for 4% of the GDPs, global GDPs. But in terms of numbers, they comprise the one-third of the IMF membership and one-fifth of the world populations. So that's why you can see it is our mandate to serve these countries. It is our objectives and missions to keep them engaged and in issues and circumstances of these countries, of course, are often different from other groups of the memberships which IMF has it, and of course merit a separate yeah, analysis. So that's why this is the broader sort of background, or if you want, the context. We have been preparing the report and on the macroeconomic development and prospect of low-income developing countries. This is our third year's preparing this report. It just issued in January, so we very, very much like take these opportunities to share the findings and discuss the in details what is the prospect. And to some extent, we propose cover a wide range of the issues, and we propose the possibly sometimes more questions than answers that need all of us to provide input. So I'm looking forward later on my colleagues at the fund and also the colleagues at the Brookings and other institutions will provide their insight into the discussions. So I'm not sure you can read it because it's the white gray. So I have what I'm going to talk about today is several blocks. First, I will explain to you what is the purpose of the studies, and then moving on, what is the main theme of the studies, and then the next is what is our assessment and outlook, and then move on to what is our advice. Go back a little bit. Yeah, what is our policy advice, and then touch upon once the doctor make the diagnosis, what is the treatment. So what is our work now and more the work to come, and later on, of course, I conclude the sessions. So let me start with the purpose. And as I explained, we have our mandate, but on top of it, particularly for this year's, we have the we have the something called the Sustainable Development Goals. This is the official name is, as you know, is the 2030 Development Agenda. The international communities agreed upon in 2015 that the Sustainable Development Goals, or in acronyms SDGs, everybody agreed to work together to achieve it by 2030s. I'm not going to discuss each and every of them. What I want pointing out that this SDG agreed at the platform UN and also endorsed by the subsequent G20 summit and all various of the international arenas. And IMF also, of course, actively participated in the work in terms of through the various kind of the working groups. And of course, we committed in a number of aspects. That's why I wanted committed. That's why I want to put them up up front. So in terms of that, we at IMF try to help achieve the SDG together with other development partners through, for example, scaling up the support for domestic revenue mobilizations by expanding the infrastructure policy support and increasing engagement with fragile and conflict-affected states. And of course, we are now trying to operationalize work on income and gender inequalities, and of course, on economic, financial, and social inclusions. And of course, we will also continue to strengthen our financial support for low-income developing countries. So these are the initiatives in a broader sense. Let me now touch upon the theme, the main theme. The theme is, for this year's report, is pretty much the...
don't touch the...
Okay, moves. All right. Is what is the difference of this year's themes compared with last year's? So the main theme is we are trying to look at is there is a, no, there is a, the major sort of the changes in terms of the cycle of the commodity prices. And what is the policy adjustment needed to these, we call the severe shocks to commodity prices. And as you can see from this very simple, but quite illustrative picture is the you saw the commodity super cycle saw the commodity prices fall to less than half of the levels we have seen before, starting from, for example, in the middle of the 2014s. And particularly, this is if you see the red lines on this fuel or oil prices, that give you even more sort of the phenomenon, a trend. And so last year, we document the shocks and look at the impact on growth, inflation, and fiscal external positions. And nowadays, according to our staff assessment, this the cycle or the lower level of the commodity prices will be persistent despite the recent uptick a little bit, but will be persistent for stay for a while. Then so this is going to be stay with us, particularly stay with these low income countries. And then the question is how are we going to do it? What is the challenges? But before we open up the advices, then let me go through what is the staff assessment on the performance side. And as you see, most of the low income countries experienced a strong and sustained growth more than decades before this super cycle ended, and of course the. It's all happened before the coincidentally with the period of the global financial crisis. But right after the, like I said, the in the middle of 2014, there is a sharp and sustained, at least sustained until now, the decline in terms of the GDP growth, together, of course, with the commodity prices. And you can see that overall, is declining in terms of growth, and more sharply on the what we call it the commodity exporters, and particularly for fuel exporters compared with other non-fuel commodity exporters. And you see actually the other group, which we call diversified economies. These are less sort of the commodity export-dominant economies, or even sometimes they have net importers. They actually experience rather limited fluctuations or slowing down in terms of growth. So you can see the overall for the entire group, the growth slowdown. But less impact on the diversified economies compared with the commodity exporters, and particularly the fuel exporters. And the downturn obviously had a impact on a number of the aspects in the economies. First of all, you see the fiscal conditions is deteriorated, and both in terms of the balance and also in terms of the stock. On the debt. And if you take the red lines, which is this is sort of more pronounced in terms of the oil exporters. Both of the balances deteriorated quite sharply, and the debt stock picked up rapidly since the, around the neighborhood of the financial crisis. I don't want to get into the details, but the clearly is self-illustrated by itself. And if you go further, as a result, the reserve coverage also weakened quite a bit in terms of the number of the coverage of the number of months, which is standard, which is using as illustrations. But if you really go get into the numbers, I will show the similar pictures and very steady deteriorating in terms of the coverage of the external sector buffers. And in terms of the sentiment, at the fund, we do the annual surveys for our memberships. And if you look at the sentiment in these countries, look at what the percentage of the currently under stress, what is the likelihood of the financial stress in the next immediate futures or in the medium or short to medium terms, 12, 18 months. So these are all the survey data will show the sentiment increasingly pointed to the financial distress. And what about the outlooks? The outlook suggests overall the recovery in the next couple of years is quite modest. And of course, with a sizable downside risk. And I can just point out a few number of it. For example, the growth rate will accelerate a little bit from 3.7% in 2006 to the 5% in 2017, 2018. I mean, in terms of the increase by the growth numbers, sounds like a little bit, quite not very small, 3.7 to 5. But don't forget, these are low-income countries. The base is quite low, so that increase is not enough to pull them out as we expected. And particularly, many of these recoveries will attribute it to the recent uptick in terms of the commodity prices, including oil, but that won't, change the long-term pictures here. And of course, in terms of the current account balances, will remain broadly unchanged. But the growing import demand in the diversified economies that also play the role. So overall, you can see that the number doesn't change much, and all pointed to the pictures for the next couple of years, not that solid as we expected, or as we wish to be that kind of level of the solid. So, in terms of the risk, and I can name a few of them. One is the slower than projected global growth, and because of the this geopolitical uncertainties, and of course the anticipated the commodity prices remained weaker, and some also the role played by we are facing the normalization of the monetary policies in the major advanced economies, and of course, finally, which is the old problems, many of the low-income countries are very vulnerable to natural disasters and because of their size and locations. So these are the assessment. Moderate recovery, but downside risks. So what to do? What is our policy advice? I should going up quickly a little bit. What we see our advice is pretty much under the two fronts. One is, of course, still keep the macroeconomic stabilities. Macroeconomic stability, we means we will continue to build economic resilience through, for example, strong broad-based tax system and ample reserve positions that will buffer us against external shocks and so forth. And more importantly, of course, there could be the structural reforms coming from different angles, economic diversifications and the strengthening up of educations for capacity buildings, and of course the agriculture productivities and stronger institution and so forth. But this year's themes, we have a highlight that pointed to the infrastructure investment. And so let's zoom in on infrastructure a little bit. We take an in-depth look at the infrastructure investment in the low-income countries, and we find that infrastructure is essential for stimulating strong, sustainable, and inclusive growth for these countries. And as you know that, the infrastructures in these economies obviously lag behind both advanced countries and emerging markets. So there is a demand, obviously. There is a gap, obviously. So how to do it? How to make up the things? And one of the, response is how to finance these things, how to enhance the infrastructure investment. And what we are pointing to is try to strengthen the domestic resource mobilizations. And you have to come in from your own revenue base rather than, compared entirely to external assistance. And second, of course, you have to pay the efficiencies of the public investment. Indeed, our assessment have made us convinced that these low-income countries had a higher proportion of public sector investment. But still, the efficiency is a problem. And of course, the involvement, engagement of the private sectors in these areas, still there is a bigger gap on it. So understanding these issues, then what the IMF is doing and what we are going to provide further help in these areas. So of course, we begin with our assistance that the policy advice. Policy advice, we will go through our normal surveillance operations, so Article 4, and also at the multilateral levels, we have a regional surveillance. We also have a multilateral surveillance product. These are all going well, we have been doing for years. And second, of course, the capacity development. And I named quite a few number of the acronyms. These are the new initiatives. I don't want to get into the details, but overall, these are initiatives we developed these days, give developing countries, low-income countries, a framework so that they can pick from each of these initiatives to help them train their staff, build their institutions, to develop capacities. Because we think the capacity development is the most needed in these countries. And of course, finally, we need continue to provide financial support, and not only continue to provide the support, but also we want to increase the support. As you see, during the last 3 years, our support in terms of financial in financial terms actually picked up quite rapidly. And not only that, we provide our concessional facilities by 50%. And on top of it, we're setting permanently zero interest rate on our rapid credit facilities, which is the instrument to support these low-income countries. So we try to provide the more help, and we provide the help at a lower cost, and also we provide the help with skills, try to help them to gain the capacities in these areas. And that's what we have been doing. And looking ahead, we have continuous, work on by focusing more on sort of the emerging issues. One is the, the macro structural policies and income inequalities in low-income countries, and social safeguard. I think later on the panel will discuss on it, Jo-Marie, and you work on it. And also the debt sustainability framework. This is a joint work. We work together with the World Bank. So all of these are on the agenda. And so that's pretty much bring my sort of introductions to the end. So but before I go going away, let me just recap what is the main takeaway from it. So basically, is the we are facing a subdued the global commodity prices, and we are also facing a divergent challenges for these low-income countries, ranging from commodity exporters to more diversified economies. And size-wise, we have a big-sized countries like Nigeria. We also have very, very small-sized economies in those, Pacific areas. But nonetheless, all of them are facing, increasingly adverse economic prospect and need to focus on the policy, the areas with priority responses for policy actions. And very important is that how to better place the infrastructures into the development agendas. And here, there's no miracles, but you have to get to the infrastructures be into a efficient management, and you have to get the private sector to get involved in this development of infrastructures to tap the resources, not only the public sources, but only the from the private sectors. So that's pretty much ended my introduction sessions, and I leave the floor to the panels. Thank you very much.
I'd like to I'd like to invite our panelists to come join us on the stage, if you will. And we'll get everyone mic'd up. Thank you so much, Dr. Zhang. That's tremendous insights and much grist to discuss. So we'll look forward to this now. Thank you. All right. Well, while we get the mics set up, I'll just take a moment to introduce our panel. First is the person next to me, who in many ways needs no introduction, of course.
I feel it.
But, delighted to be with a longtime, friend, colleague, role model on some of these issues. Really the dean of African economics and economic policy, Donald Kaburuka. He's a former president of the African Development Bank, former finance minister of Rwanda. I think African of the Year at least once. But... most recently, since he stepped down and concluded two very successful terms at the African Development Bank, has been based out of Harvard at the Kennedy School, where he's a Hauser Fellow in Residence. And he's been recently appointed Special Envoy of the African Union Peace Fund, and has also been very active in the AU reform panel that just had a major meeting about 2 weeks ago, I think, and has been working very hard with some of the best minds from around Africa. And most recently, I should add, is also joined as a TPG, the private equity group, as an advisor. So is, you know, crossing all of the boxes in terms of cross-sectoral perspective on these issues. So Donald, we're thrilled that you're here. Thank you. Next to him is another distinguished colleague, who is Jo Marie Griesgraber. She's executive director of the New Rules for Global Finance Coalition, previously director of policy at Oxfam America, and prior to that, directed the Rethinking Bretton Woods project at the Center of Concern. She's a PhD in political science from Georgetown, just down the street, and brings to this, I think, a very complementary perspective on a lot of these social and justice issues, in addition to the institutional design questions. Next to her is our former and ongoing colleague Amadou Sy, who is, of course, the director of the Africa Growth Initiative here at Brookings until very recently, and the IMF grabbed him back to to take a senior advisor role in the Africa Department, but he's here today in his capacity as a non-resident senior fellow with Brookings and is bridging, and we'll hopefully talk a bit about some of the research that he's done in with the Brookings capacity over the past couple of years and how that relates to today's topic. And then last but certainly not least is Dr. Sean Nolan at the end, who is Deputy Director of the Strategy, Policy, and Review Department of the IMF and really led the work on this report, I think, with the team under Dr. Zhang's direction. So delighted that you're here too, Sean. So as our lead discussant, if you will, I would love to give a bit of time to Donald Kalbaruka to share his thoughts on the report, but these topics and the issues more broadly that you think the low-income developing countries are facing right now.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Good afternoon. I want to begin by saying that I think this is an excellent report. I want to commend the IMF staff for the work done. There's very little here one can disagree with. I'll simply point out areas I think require a lot of attention beyond what I've mentioned here by the fund. I want also to say that how far the relationship between the IMF and low-income countries have come. Believe me, if you had come to the IMF in 2000 and mentioned infrastructure, they would think you must be coming from Mars. Infrastructure was not qualified as a priority expenditure in fund programs. So you had the social sectors. These were classified as priority expenditures. But infrastructure was classified with foreign affairs and military as non-priority expenditures. So again, congratulations, IMF. You have come a long way to understanding the link between economic growth and economic transformation. Because the notion that low-income countries were objects of welfare, international welfare, was quite widespread in those days. I recall a conversation I had with the former MD of the IMF, Horst Köhler, at the time. He could see my logic when I was going to say, look, we need to spend more on energy, on connectivity, on highways, on water. But in the programs, you have put them in non-priority expenditures. So I think the fund has come a long way in innovation, more instruments, but also understanding what is it that low-income countries need to move away from the category of low-income countries. After all, remember, the low-income category is supposed to be a temporary category, because every country on planet Earth has been poor at some point, some of them very recently. So the idea that low-income country is a transitional category is something we must try to hammer down into a policy framework. Number two, but if the IMF has changed, low-income countries too have changed. And I like very much the approach here at DMD of classifying them with a different taxonomy. They're so different. But something else has happened too, which I think it is important to bear in mind. For example, as you approach the work on financial stress, low-income countries have seen rich countries mess up their financial sector with a huge negative impact on low-income countries. And therefore, you'll have to be careful and approach this by saying financial stresses are not a specific problem of low-income countries. it is a global problem. Some of it we know, others like an iceberg, we don't know. But I think it is important to approach this from what are the interrelationships of these financial flows. An example, during the global financial crisis, we were called upon by the G20 to provide trade finance. We don't do trade finance, it's not our area. But as European banks were retrenching from Africa, there was a gap on this particular instrument. I suspect now with the new Basel rules, there will even be more need for institutions like the World Bank and others to provide instruments we didn't provide in the past. But also low-income countries have seen lessons from the emerging markets. They have looked carefully at China, at Brazil, at India, and so on. And there are lessons there, some of which would be non-traditional lessons you get from the International Monetary Fund. The reason I mention this, my friends, is because I really like this infrastructure approach. But remember, in the last few years, the biggest contributor to infrastructure finance in low-income countries has been China and the capital markets. And so there had to be some rethinking of how much debt space, fiscal space you want to allow to make sure that power, highways, and airports are built. It would be very important to understand that while capacity building for these countries is important, there will be some lumpy expenditures in the short term to try to close the infrastructure gap. And I'm glad in some countries you're doing that. But the biggest problem I have with this report, though, I don't know if it is a problem or just an observation, and since I'm no longer president of the bank, I can speak to you freely. I think it makes too big a story of commodities. It is as if low-income countries are a function of what happens in the commodity markets. I would say you have to nuance this story and have two reasons. Number one, as you could see from the chart here, it is the net importers of oil, for example, who are sitting on 6 months of reserves, where the fiscal tensions, BOP tensions, is lower because there have been major beneficiaries. So I do think the issue here is not about commodities. We need to look at commodities. We need to look at investment, determinants of investment. We look at domestic demand, and we need to look at the impact of more regional trade, especially in Africa. I think you may want to take another look at this commodity issue. In our days, when I was in the bank, I asked our economists to go country by country to try to give a ballpark number. What's the impact of this commodity super cycle? To be honest with you, we came around to a number like maybe 30%. But the rest is very much driven by investment, huge amounts of investment in infrastructure in particular, regional trade, especially in ECOWAS and the South African regional space. And therefore, you may want to nuance this for that reason alone and other factors. My second reason, which should not be controversial, I hope, is that although the super cycle has come to an end, commodity prices are still quite high. Remember, there was a time when Nigerian budget was based on a $40 barrel of oil. Today we're at 52. So there's still a lot of things they can do on the commodity side. Because I think the case of Nigeria, actually, they have suffered more from the Delta crisis, so lower volumes being produced, maybe than the price effect. But I think if you look whether it is copper, whether it is coffee, whether it is oil, prices are reasonably high compared to what they were a couple of years back. And therefore, I like the emphasis here on saying to these oil exporters, you have room to expand the fiscal base. That is a fact. Not the Nigerians would deny it, or the Angolans or the Congolese. I don't know about other countries. So we can expand the fiscal base. Do so. I like the emphasis here on exchange rate flexibility. Because at least the African countries have observed, the net oil exporters, if they had worked hard on expanding the fiscal base, if they had been realistic in terms of the exchange rate flexibility, I think the capacity to absorb the shock of the oil from 90 to 40 would have been much easier. I want to urge you to continue working with these countries on this. But don't give them an impression that hell has come down to them because oil price from 80 to 40. No, it hasn't. It's an oil price which still provides space for them to do fiscal adjustments. They have challenges on the BOP, on the balance of payments. But if they allow exchange rate flexibility, they are in a better position to adjust. And finally, this was maybe another point I think could have been given greater emphasis. Maybe it's in the report, I don't know. This whole issue of inclusion and what it means for the work of the fund. You know, growth is important. One staff of the fund used to say that growth is a starting point for inclusion, unless you want to have inclusive misery. But if you want to have inclusive growth, there has to be growth. So I agree. But growth is only a means to better human living conditions. So what does it take in terms of fiscal space? What does it take in terms of composition of expenditures? What does it take in terms of education, agriculture, gender, and so on, the kind of things DMD mentioned? I would like to see these things having as big a weight as commodities so that there could be a better conversation. Finally, you gave me 10 minutes. I'm not 10 minutes yet.
You're doing great.
Finally, you begin by pointing out the Sustainable Development Goals, on which, by the way, John worked a lot. He's a guru on this issue in the room. But so what does it mean, all these nice things? It means two things. A, we have to find the financing. So among the IFIs, we held many meetings with Ban Ki-moon at the time and produced a report called From Billions to Trillions. There was a clear understanding that we need to be smarter in terms of identifying additional resources to fund all these things. Now, the Millennium Development Goals, again, which John worked very hard, were premised on more aid from rich countries to poor countries. Not rich governments, philanthropy, so many things. And the progress we have made on health, for example, on infant mortality, on HIV/AIDS, has been a function of huge amounts of inflow into the health sector in our countries. But the SDGs are different. They are not premised on more aid, because there's no aid. Rich countries are no longer rich as they were in the past. At least this is what they tell us. The source of funding is now very diverse, very diverse. But the biggest of them, the biggest of them, is domestic resources. And so I do believe that probably, maybe I didn't look at the report well, the emphasis on what the countries themselves are doing to raise more funding for their development, how they spend the money, whether from natural resources or from other areas, is extremely important for the fund. It is not simply about capacity building. No, it's about things like illicit flows. So what do we do about this? The report came out, it shows illicit flows. I'm not saying criminal flows, it is illicit flows. On taxation, on the race to the bottom by countries giving all these investment incentives, right? If together we could work on that area alone to give meaning to this report by Thabombeki and others, at least for Africa, that would be a huge start to make sure the countries fund their own SDGs. But if these multinational corporations who come to our countries continue to act the way they've acted in the past, and all of us think this is a minor problem, then you can't go from billions to trillions by countries mobilizing their own resources. Of course, there are governance issues and so on, but I think it's such a big issue that it requires attention from the fund. Now, these are my modest points. I hope that you find them useful, but I'm happy to answer more if you wish. Thank you.
Thank you, Donald. And I think interesting, I picked up just in some of the charts a few of the same points as you. The commodity index in several of the countries is still above 100. And the fuel is the lowest, but others are, compared to 2005. And it even gets to this point, even the aid is not about to grow, but it's still higher than it was in many countries in 2005. So a lot of these are relative shocks, and a lot of these are long-term structural shifts. And so I think the point of a report like this is ultimately to help frame the debate. So it's doing that in a very constructive way today on these issues. Now let's turn to Joe Marie. I'd like to share your thoughts on, again, the report and the broader issues for low-income developing countries more broadly.
Well, thank you very much, and congratulations to the team who wrote the report and some of the other reports that have been coming out of the IMF. It is not your same old IMF. I've been working on the IMF, I believe it's about 27 years now, based on the age of the child with which I was pregnant when I started. I have a great marker. I know how long I've worked on the fund. And I would like you to recommend two papers that complement this one. And it's the very new, very hot off the press, Macro Structural Policies and Income Inequality and LIDCs. And I know at least one of the authors, Stefania Fabrizio, is here. They've done a brilliant job of looking at pilot countries where the IMF has been testing. How do you really implement the policies of reducing inequality, protecting, they're called safeguards in the IMF, they're targeted conditional or non-conditional cash transfers is the preferred form. And there's a second paper that is really one of my Bibles when I try to say, and the fund is doing this really great stuff. It is called Staff Report on Spillovers on International Corporate Taxation.
Oh.
It's the May 2014 with Michael Keane and Vicky Perry. These are some of the heroes of the fund right now. It's really a radical transformation of the institution. When you look at, now, I like to hold the fund's feet to the fire because that's a position I've got down pretty good, you know. I know how to criticize and prod. In the tax paper, there are four pro-poor tax policies. And some of them are mentioned, you know, in this paper, but I like to complement and bring them together. In fact, it would be a challenge for the IMF to integrate these perspectives, you know, all this advice and training you're going to be giving them. Not you, you, whoever you are.
No,
okay, the four pro-poor policies are VAT, which I love to hate. I think it's regressive, and sometimes the fund paper even calls it regressive. Yes, we're winning. Personal income tax, corporate income tax, and then the one that's sort of the ghost, and that's property tax. That's where a lot of work can be done. It's extremely progressive. I know because I pay real estate taxes in Fairfax County. I know, listen, you can't run away from your real estate tax. You just can't unless you're going to live in a trailer someplace on wheels and you still keep moving. Okay, so those are the integrations that still have to happen with the conversation about all this stuff you're going to do. Not to disparage it, okay? I am not an economist. I can talk like that.
Yeah, but that's right.
Okay. The other point I'd like to say is that what is absent in this and in some of the other things I've been looking at is the consultations needed with technical advice or with the advice the IMF gives. For example, not to name names, but I do, it's my job, on the Institute for Capacity Development, there's a strategic plan by one of those departments called MCM, but I don't know what it stands for, so I'm not guilty of pointing fingers, of course. They consult with everyone in the IMF, and they consult occasionally with governments they virtually never consult with regional banks. They certainly don't consult with the ATAF for Tax Administrators Forum or the CIAT in the Inter-American Tax Administrators Conference. Work with regional partners. You know, peer-to-peer training is really better than having someone who knows everything in Washington come in and tell you everything you need to know and then leave. So also, in terms of the financial advice you provide, and now we have at least five new acronyms to learn. I'm sorry, but by the time I got to that point in the paper, my head just, I said, I can't learn any more acronyms. I hope somebody else can pick and choose, and I hope everybody in Washington knows everything they need to know about this. I can't guarantee that. All right, now, what they need to do with finance, it's very tricky. You make a lot of mistakes are easy. Work with the Financial Stability Board. It's impacting Africa. You may as well have a voice within the Financial Stability Board. You can do that both through the regional consultative groups, which can tend to be top-down. There are six of them. They meet sporadically. Read their press releases. You will learn nothing. But the countries are present in the room, and they can make demands. You can also work with the secretariat. You can work with the representatives of the G20 governments who are friendly. I won't say Dan Turullo, God love him, he's leaving, though. There are other people who are very open and supportive. They can work with and get your views in and talk with you about the consequences. You don't have to be victims. I just want to say debt, God forbid, not again. 27 years, debt. Why don't we have a global bankruptcy mechanism for nation states? They pay market rate interest. Why can't they get debt relief? And then when looking at fuel exporters and the need for energy, God bless all the poor countries. They're all in the tropical zone. Solar. Don't depend on fuel. Go with climate protection. I'm sorry, that's all my preaching. That's all the time I give. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Jo Marie, we're going to come back and have more conversations. So that's just a first pass, but hoping to broaden the agenda of discussion. Amadou, how you've been researching a lot of these questions from different perspectives in the past few years. What would you like to, add to the conversation?
Yeah, sure. Allow me to make a pitch for our recent report called Africa Foresight, where we try to discuss a whole set of issues, including how countries are adjusting to the commodity price shock. It's available in the internet, and it's a great report. I think this report, and along with other IMF reports, have a very, very important public good element. Having been here at Brookings, it's a nonprofit, I can tell you it's very useful to be able to have these documents, the statistical annexes and so on, and use them to start a conversation. You don't have to agree, but they're very useful. They're free, so which is great. The second thing is, when we did look at the case of these commodity exporters. And then what happens is you see this boom-bust cycle again. You see the prices of oil going down. You see twin deficits, current account and budget deficits shooting up, which means that you have to finance them. And the problem is that the external financing requirement are increasing exactly at the same time as financial conditions are kind of tightening, right? And so then you have, if you put yourself in the shoes of these policymakers, if you're the Minister of Finance in one of these countries, even Mongolia, which is a huge commodity exporter, suddenly money is dried up and you have to find some. And you have to also have credible and decisive adjustment. And the problem is we've seen many countries have a kind of tentative reaction, a kind of slow reaction. And then you see their reserves going down. You see parallel exchange rates popping up. You see control, the central bank having to control who gets dollars or not. All these are signs that something's not going right? And so as you have to deal with this short-term shock, you have also the SDGs that you have to achieve, right? So you basically have this big short-term problem. You need the pain medicine. It's hurting. And at the same time, you have this medium-term to long-term objective that you have to achieve. And they are both related. So these guys and women are really facing a tough situation here. And so typically then, in terms of the short-term adjustment, your reserves are going down, so you need to do something. It's difficult to borrow outside, although Nigeria managed to do it, but at a high cost. So the typical medicine is you have fiscal contraction, you have to let the exchange rate take some of the adjustment, you need to increase the interest rate, but then you have to some inflation to because when exchange rate goes down, you might have some inflation, so you increase the interest rate. At the same time, you're checking your state-owned enterprises, you're checking your financial sector to see whether you have some unintended problems from for example, banks depend a lot on the oil sector, and you have the oil sector having a problem, so you don't want these banks to go in trouble because of that. And if it doesn't work, or if you want more help, you go to the IMF, you go to the World Bank, you go to the African Development Bank. And it's happening, right? But while all of that is happening, I think one should also, this saying that never let a good crisis go to waste, is that to also maybe take this crisis as an opportunity to really, fix the machine. The problem is oil exporting countries, they are like oil tankers, it's very slow to turn the tanker, right? But you have to do it. And that's where all these issues of structural transformation, the role of agriculture, the role of agro-processes, this huge issue of domestic revenue mobilization, as was said, I mean, that's really where most of your income revenues are coming from. And you have to deal with it. And in oil exporting countries, this means tough questions. What do you do with the VAT? Where in many oil exporting countries, the VAT is some of the lowest in the world, right? But it's a regressive tax, so what do you do? And there you have advice that you can count on, and there it's your choice, but you have to do something about it. How about the non-oil sector, right? If you look at the GDP rebasing exercises, you see that the non-oil sector has grown a lot in many countries, but it's not being taxed, right? It's not contributing that much to fiscal revenues. So what do you do with that, right? Role of the private sector. Right, you might have a private sector that also might have been too dependent on oil, or you did not give the non-oil private sector enough incentive, enough choices, or reducing its constraint to pop up, right? Including SMEs, role of the financial sector, role of the institutions, and also. But yeah, 1 minute. So my last minute is devoted to my last point, which is I think this is also the time to revisit the social compact, right? During boom times, prices of oil was good, was high, you had winners, and some sectors, some parts of the economy benefited a lot from this boom. So now that we are in a bust, or maybe too low for long, we don't know, but I think it's wise to maybe think of it as a permanent shock. What is happening when you adjust? You will again have winners and losers. So maybe it's time to revisit this social contract. Maybe some of the winners in the boom time have to chip in now, right? So I think the report is very rich, and that's one issue. There's so much you can do. But basically 3 points. You have the short-term adjustment, the pain medicine that is needed. But second, you have these SDGs and, you know, all these medium to long-term issues that you have to deal with. And this is the time to use the crisis to revisit the social compact. So I'll come back to maybe some other issues during the Q&A.
Right. Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you so much, Amadou. I think these issues that are being raised, it's maybe a question for Sean then. You know, there's a challenge in writing a report like this, mm-hmm. and you have to boil the ocean to distill amidst a lot of complex dynamics.
Yeah.
There's a reporting function, there's an analytical function, there's a policy set of questions and functions that are embedded. And just, you know, summarize a few of the points that have come up. You have, the near versus long-term economic dynamics and growth dynamics even beyond the macro principles. You have these very fundamental issues of tax and tax cooperation, which are, of course, somewhat on reset now after some of the legislative changes, executive order in this country on the extractive industry just last week. So that, a lot of people I know who have been working on that issue for a long time feel like that's not moving forwards, to put it one way. You have these debt issues and the long-term macro issues, which haven't come up yet, interestingly, in a deep way on the kind of the bond issuances of a lot of low-income countries. We're starting to see, of course, the U.S. Fed announce a climb of its interest rates, but a very uncertain path. I know a lot of macro economists looking at low-income borrowing and are nervous about what that's going to look like in the next 5 to 10 years. So I'm just curious your reflections on the comments you've heard and how you might respond to them as someone who is driving this analysis, but also, for the benefit of the audience, any reflections on how you choose at a time like this what to put in a report that's so important?
Okay, I'll try and answer that big question with a few short points. One thing I think was important in the message from the report is the idea of actually diversity across low-income countries. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to tell a homogenous story, which is almost, it's actually not, it's dangerously wrong. Mm-hmm. The collapse of oil prices was a disaster for Nigeria. Mm-hmm. For Bangladesh and Ethiopia, it was extremely good news.
Yes.
And it's that, and what I think the report charts show very clearly is that basic message. A lot of countries are continuing to do very well. East Africa, Southeast Asia, low-income countries in those areas are doing well. The countries that are doing poorly are those who have been hit by the commodity price shock, and let's be candid, who have mismanaged the commodity boom previously. None of us talked about a crisis in Nigeria in 2009 when the world price of oil was down in the dumps again. And the answer was why? The Nigerians had built up $60, $70 billion of reserves in the previous 4 or 5 years, which is what, of course, you should do with a highly volatile commodity revenue. This time around, that money wasn't there. So we got a very different story that Donald described, the rationing of foreign exchange and actual economic contraction. So one big point there is avoiding the stereotypes and saying what is the interesting division in this particular case. In other issues, commodity exports are not germane, but interpreting is not the interesting division, but interpreting the macro of what's happened in the last 2 years, that's the divider between those who are doing well and those who are doing not. Donald's points about the need to look at illicit financial flows or as part of the broader DRM, domestic revenue mobilization, mm-hmm. agenda are well taken. It's funny, when you take that issue, which has had a lot of political momentum from the Mbeki report and so forth, and then you take it to the technocrats, the technocrats see things very much in tax terms, for example, or rather than they don't combine a whole range of issues. Corruption is one issue to be dealt by this group. Tax is another issue to be dealt by this group. We agree entirely that within the whole area of tax, and I think that tax... it's actually probably the central, most important issue in terms of IFFs. I take the point entirely on the importance of international tax cooperation. Mm. It's not BEPS alone and implementing new rules will not deliver. There's more that's needed. The whole issue of the push by the G20 on issues relating to beneficial transparency and beneficial ownership, these are all really important parts of the picture. And they're issues that we will be paying more attention to, I guarantee you. On the issue of infrastructure, I think we get it on infrastructure. We actually get it on inequality, the importance of both. We're not players on infrastructure except in terms of state capacity. Actually, to be very candid, part of our motivation in focusing on the topic was to give a greater push to the billions to trillions agenda, which has produced a lot of rhetoric in 2015, but is still not yielding much in terms of results. And that's where the current G20 initiative on the compact with Africa may actually have some positive effects. A last comment, I think, on the debt bond issue points that you mentioned. I think we've seen, obviously, a number of countries slipping back into debt distress. Mozambique would be an obvious example that would come to mind. When we look at it here, we see what I'd call there's no sort of clear picture of generalized rising distress, but there is a picture of a number of countries moving into dangerous terrain for different reasons. We're looking at this in the context of revising our debt sustainability framework, which is a methodology for trying to look at debt sustainability over the medium term and trying to draw lessons from it. Certainly bringing the whole question of bond issues into that framework is something we've been looking at closely. It's an issue I think that everyone has to follow. Certainly those who are following low-income country issues will need to keep an eye on is indeed the problem of rising debt burden. But I don't see it as a systemic issue. I see it as a not idiosyncratic, but because there's a significant number of countries, but it's not a generalized trend. And maybe I should stop there, actually. Great.
Well, thank you, and thank you all. And thanks to the audience. You've been terrific. We're at about 10 after 2 right now. You've been very, I can see everyone pay close attention, hanging on every word of 6 people so far. So I'm a little bit unorthodox on all these things because I don't think human beings like to sit still for too long. But we want to open it up to questions and answer for a little bit. So just as an experiment, I just want to challenge everyone or even give you the opportunity to grab the person next to you and just say, what's the one question you'd like to ask if you could? Because we're not going to be able to hear from everyone, but I think it's a nice thing to just say, like, what's the one thing if you could ask? And I'll say, I don't know if we have a hashtag for this event, but if anyone wants to tweet or a question at me, I'll look at my phone at MacArthur, and I'll see if anything comes up from the room, just an opportunity for those of you who are on Twitter. But just take 15, 20 seconds, grab the person next to you. What's a question that's burning in your mind right now that you'd like to ask? And then we'll see which ones we can get up here. And I'm going to come back to the panel in just a second. So take 20 seconds.
It's a bit, Joe Marie, I think it's a bit early in the day for 1 or 2 Twitter users to be active.
Okay. It was 20 seconds. We're efficient here. All right. So I'd like to open it up, and we've talked. I'm going to just ask one question of the panel, see where they'd like to chime in on it, and then open it up. And we've talked a lot about the issues that could be added to a report like this and could be added to the agenda. I'd love it if we could focus on this infrastructure bit a little bit, because it was, Donald's signature issue in many ways at the bank. And, you pushed so hard to put this on the front page internationally. We've seen more and more of this effort. It's linked to the billions to trillions agenda. It's linked to the domestic resource mobilization. It's linked to the private sector mobilization. And I would say, and it's linked to the climate change, it's everything. It's really kind of the mega interface issue of the macroeconomics of the sustainable development goals, because the dollars implied are so large. I'm curious, I don't feel like we're there yet in terms of mobilizing where we need to mobilize, but I'm curious, just each of you, what do you see as the most crucial next step to get the infrastructure financing or the right types of infrastructure financing where they need to be for the low-income developing countries? Donald?
Well, first of all, I want to say that three of Africa's fastest growing economies today, which is Ethiopia, Rwanda, and the Ivory Coast. By the way, all of them non-oil exporters. They have shared three things in common. Number one, they have sustained the macroeconomic reforms of the previous years. They have not wasted the momentum. In other countries, that momentum has been lost. Number two, try as much to integrate with the neighborhood. Ethiopia with Djibouti, they have just finished the railway, which cuts travel from 10 days to 10 hours. Heavy investment in infrastructure. Same as my own country. You just have to go to Rwanda and see how infrastructure has transformed these countries. The reason is that poor infrastructure costs low-income countries at least 2% of growth every year. And so if the fund is going to move from structural adjustment to structural transformation, we have to figure out how to work together to fund infrastructure. Now, so where is the money? The money is not the problem. There's so much money in the world today chasing yield that they're in all kinds of things. So the secret is, how do we get this money into infrastructure space? And all of us know what to do. Things to do is de-risking, especially early stages. Before I left the bank, we set up a special fund to do that in Casablanca Financial City. So early stage de-risking, not easy, but can be done. I would like to see more aid money being used to do de-risking than envelope every 4 years like they do in IDA. Can we get a bit of IDA money to do de-risking so the private sector can actually invest in infrastructure? How do we make sure that what happened on telecoms in the 1990s after deregulation, when private capital has flown in massively in IT, how do we make sure this happens in energy, in railways, in airports? It can only happen if there is early stage de-risking. So I think this is where the conversation should be. I tried, I didn't succeed, to say that at every replenishment, if you give us, I don't know, $4 billion, can you use $1 billion just to do de-risking? I didn't succeed. So I hope that we can do more thinking around this area, because it is the only way we can attract private capital into infrastructure.
Jeremy, what your thoughts? You can punt on that one if you want.
I'm going to pass on this one.
Okay.
I'm neither know low income, nor do I know anything about infrastructure.
You're too modest.
No, I'm not.
But, I mean, we've worked a bit on infrastructure here with some colleagues like Jeff Goodman and so on, and talked a lot to investors, participants, people from development banks and so on. And just two things. One is that, I mean, I agree with Donald that the idea is that, like, how do you basically make sure that the money that is out there finds its way to these huge needs that are out there, and so although at the beginning I wasn't convinced for some reason, but every time I talk to these private investors, this whole issue of project preparation, de-risking, is really key. And I didn't know that, but apparently you can make money.
Oh, yeah.
Just working on project preparation. It's a line of business. I didn't
yes.
know that. Sorry, but it's a line of business. And so the African Development Bank has set up this Africa 50. Even here in the U.S., there's an agency. Now I have to remember the name. But there's an agency whose role is really to work on project preparation and facilitate and work on this de-risking. So really, more money, is needed into this project preparation issue. The other thing is, we looked a little bit at how to attract institutional investors. You know, you have these trillions of dollars in pension fund money, in sovereign wealth fund money, and so on. And then when we talk to them and so on, like, I remember talking to this Swedish pension fund manager who was like, we want size, we want simplicity, and we want standardization. You know, if not, we're not putting money in it. And then, so if you look at the infrastructure project, really, it seems that you have to separate the greenfield projects from the brownfield projects. When projects are new, these are greenfield projects, it's very hard to attract institutional investors, except maybe a few that know how to do it, like some Canadian pension fund and some countries that whose pension fund have a expertise on that. But in general, you know, you need development bank, you need the governments and so on to put money in the project preparation and in the greenfield project. Now, once you have these greenfield projects becoming brown, and you have these brownfield projects, and then you can attract the institutional investors who would love to. So, for example, I discovered that the New York pension fund, one of the New York pension funds, has in its asset allocation, in principle, 3% that it wants to allocate to Africa. Why 3%? They did the calculation in world GDP and so on. So they are ready. But where do they want to put the money? It would be brownfield, toll road, and so on. And I think there's an initiative going on to encourage that. They will take them to Africa and so on. But the simple question, I think it's project preparation, and separate greenfield from brownfield, and have government money, aid money, and so on in the greenfield.
Thanks, Amadou. And Sean, do you have any thoughts on this?
I will not repeat what Amadou said. I would just say I echo what he said. I think that the points he's made are very important. I actually just take it from the narrow angle of the IMF, and I'd say there the two angles that I think we pay a lot of attention to are firstly is the sort of debt versus growth investment trade-off. We're trying to sharpen our analytical tools there, but getting that right is really important. Getting it wrong, as you know, you end up with severe debt burdens and the ensuing macroeconomic and social stress that stems from that. So that's one area. And then the second is the question of actually, within the public sector, managing investment effectively. Issues like public procurement, like public investment management, project management, and so forth. These are areas that we're devoting more resources to, because they're areas we have some expertise in, and we think actually are particularly an area where we can make a significant contribution. That whole process of unlocking the pile of money in the north and the pile of opportunities in the south, so to speak, is moving. It's moving slowly because actually it's analytically hard.
Right.
And the market reforms and the trade-offs, say, between prudential considerations and facilitating investment in the south, all of these are difficult issues that are being pushed. And I think one interesting point I just wanted to add on to Donald's point, where he emphasized the desirability of more aid being used for the purposes of promoting or leveraging additional investment. That, as he mentioned, is happening, and the IDA 18 replenishment includes a significant amount of money for that. Mm. It will raise some interesting tensions with civil society, actually, because you'll be seeing public money that is leveraging private investment, and people will immediately be saying, why are you doing this, and is it a corporate subsidy, etc. So there's going to be an interesting marketing challenge in terms of, I don't mean marketing in a lighthearted sense, I mean it in a serious sense, a conversation about why this is a good idea, and that will be a challenge, I think.
I would say for the CSOs that the IFC sets a bad precedent, that private money goes after, you know, mega condominiums or, you know, casinos. It doesn't set a good example. It does not reduce poverty the way it's been, you know, evidenced. The other thing in terms of pension funds, private pension funds in the U.S. is the requirement for continued liquidity, mm-hmm. high need for immediate short-term liquidity, and they must take the highest returns based on state laws. So it's complicated within the U.S. anyway.
It reminds me on this point of de-risking. Homi Karas, a colleague here, and I did a little paper talking about this a couple years ago where we looked at even MIGA, whose job is to de-risk in many ways. And at the time, the MIGA contracts were worth about $1 billion a year. I think it's now up to about $3 billion, which is better, but, you know, compared to trillions, extremely small. And I think it's not blaming MIGA, it's asking the question of why is this? because even there, I think they'd only had, it was a single digits, the number of calls they'd had. I think it was six in their history. So it wasn't really providing insurance in a real sense. It was an adverse selection problem and probably in what they were insuring. And so this, and I was talking to a pension fund CEO at one point who said, you know, what they want to see is intergenerational risk insurance, because they've seen all, say on clean energy, they've seen all these policy shifts and they want to be able to invest over not just the current generation, but even the children's generation, but the grandchildren's generation. They're really looking at long-term horizons. So it's a big question of how a multilateral system can incentivize that. We just have a couple minutes for questions. So I just want to see if there are any quick questions that anyone would like to add. Maybe we'll take a couple. I'm going to ask you to be very brief and make sure it ends with a question mark. So we had this hand first, and then the second in the back, and then third up here. So if you can be brief, please.
Yeah, Peter Berlin, retired. Oh, and started infrastructure in the early 70s in the first capital development office that Congress mandated. I'm delighted to hear that it's back, or seems to be. But my question is, how are there institutions in the low-income countries actually capable of doing what you say you want them to do? And then just take the example you mentioned, which is the Ethiopia-Djibouti Railroad, which the Chinese built and just opened. Who's going to benefit and why? And are you confident that, you know, the kind of policies that are excellent and the need for the infrastructure are excellent have a receptivity within the governments you're working with?
Great, thank you. So we'll park that one and add it to, we'll take three quickly. So one in the back, please. The woman in the back, yes. Thank you. And then maybe Amy, if you can bring the mic up to the woman in the front for the final. Please, if you can introduce yourself.
My name's Hosanna. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the Nigeria example that you gave. You spoke about the importance of the private sector in investment as well as the importance of infrastructure. But in a situation like Nigeria where there's rampant corruption in both the private and public sector, how does that play into the whole like crucial next steps in like private investment and like infrastructure development? How does corruption play in, how does corruption play in actually achieving those
But it's a corruption get addressed in the Nigerian context. And up front, please.
And my name is Catherine, and mine's kind of like directed towards what you mentioned, Dr. Kabiroka, about like the MDGs were premised on like, you know, rich countries giving, you know, like a lot of money to poor countries. But the SDGs are premised on like having their, like the LDCs, the LIDCs are kind of like owning up to this, you know, like development themselves. So do you think that there is an understanding within like the LDCs that it's kind of like their turn now, or like countries still living in the expectation that the West will come in and like do it for us?
Great, thank you. Well, maybe we'll go in reverse order. I'm gonna just go from right to left here. And sorry, but we have to be brief, but just any quick thoughts you have on these great questions that have come up?
On the difficult questions on Nigeria, I'm going to pass that to the former president of the African Development Bank, who undoubtedly his biggest client. So
critical,
let me punt that
enough.
One straight away.
But on the
issue of government capacity, I think it's a very good question. I think that's why I'm saying we're placing a lot of emphasis on providing assistance in those areas. You mentioned the Djibouti Addis Railroad, which has been transformative. Is the cost-benefit analysis right? I don't know, actually. I can't speak to that, I'm sure, but I'm sure the development bankers can speak to that question. But developing the capacity to do those kinds of assessments is really key. The white elephant model of infrastructure provision is not going to generate long-term returns. Let me pass there.
If I may, very quickly, I know Donald has to catch a plane, but so on corruption, I would not answer on Nigeria specifically because this is a LIDC report. But we've just completed a report where we look at how governance indicators, including corruption, and corruption is the one that works the best, respond to different types of money, of financing. So basically, if you improve the fight against corruption, which type of money do you get the most? And we find that basically, tax to GDP responds very well, much better, actually, than foreign direct investment to improvement in fighting corruption. So, which brings us to this domestic revenue mobilization debate, because that's the biggest share of the pie, the domestic taxes. And if that research is okay, and did it with a colleague here, Mariama, then you get a big bang domestically from fighting corruption.
Okay.
Jo Marie.
Very quickly. On corruption, I would love to shift from kleptocracy even to illicit financial flows, which gives people fits because it's not illegal. It's just gray and it's being nasty and evil in your heart, even if not by your lawyer or auditor. And I think that's the biggest ripoff going, and it's up to the developed countries, and we need transparency and beneficial ownership. You want to work on that? The FACT Coalition in Washington, look it up, the FACT Coalition. The other thing about fighting corruption and recognizing domestic responsibility, there's Tax Justice Africa, there's Tax Justice Nigeria, Tax Justice Latin America. It's all domestic, and people know it and are claiming it.
Donald, final thoughts to you.
Okay. So let me go back to this conversation between the former Prime Minister of the UK and President Buhari of Nigeria. You have heard the story, haven't you? So David Cameron says, I think the tape was off, that Nigeria is a super corrupt country. I think that Buhari would be on the defensive. Buhari said, we are very corrupt, but the money is here. Can we get that money back? This is an element which I think the IMF can help enormously. G20 touches it, but complexities is still up there. So Nigerians don't deny that their country has challenges, as many countries do, as Kazakhstan or Mongolia. But they have to be cooperation to get that money back into the countries. And you know where the money is. That is the point I want to make. But the most important thing I wanted to say about Djibouti and Ethiopia, this report mentions very clearly that at the end of the day, the challenge for low-income countries is to create jobs. Now, a piece of road, railway, is just a means to an end. But the end is trade and transformation. So between Addis and Djibouti, it was taking 10 days. Now it'll be taking 10 hours. Now, I've spoken to Chinese manufacturers who are setting up shop in Addis, and they've told me they have a number of issues to go through, but logistics was the biggest problem for them to make sure they can deliver goods on time. So cooperation between Djibouti and Ethiopia, first of all, good for regional trade, brings down the cost of doing business. Number two, enables Ethiopia and Djibouti to become a basis for manufacturing and transformation and job creation. So if you ask me who is the beneficiary, I think this is everybody a winner. Is it a white elephant? I disagree. Maybe the costing, I have not gone through it, but I think we need more of those kind of projects now to get into the cycle of manufacturing so that we can create jobs. So the next report will not call us low-income countries. It requires maybe countries in transition. So I'm happy with the railway between Djibouti and Ethiopia. And I look forward to seeing more of those kind of projects. Maybe the IMF can help in the costing and make sure it is well done. But these are not white elephants.
Great. Well, what a terrific panel. What a terrific presentation. Please join me in thanking Dr. Zhang and all of our panelists for everything. I'd just like to add, we have had a couple of questions come in. There's a Nathan Copeland somewhere in the audience asking a few questions about what the IMF will do specifically on some of the PPPs and foreign currency things. So maybe you can grab Sean at the end on that. But I would also just like to underscore, this isn't your grandmother's IMF, if you will, in the sense of the leadership on the SDGs, on these broader questions. And it's a testament to the institutional leadership to take these on. Also, I would say that very sincerely, the pressures against paying attention to low-income countries around the world are quite profound right now. So a flagship report like this that really ensures ongoing debate, healthy conversations about what next is so crucial. So really kudos to the fund for doing this exercise altogether. And I would, you know, I really would just love if we can keep pushing on this structural adjustment to structural transformation theme so that these are seen as dynamic situations and a transforming agenda that we're all working on together. So thank you all, and thanks again for a terrific discussion.
Thank you.